Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Insane in the Membrane.
Insane in the Membrane.
And before we begin, I'd just like to say thank you to... We've got a couple of supporters for the podcast. We have Dame Theatre and we have Danny P. They are... You click on the button to support this podcast via Acast. Thank you for that, guys. Really do appreciate it. Also... coming out at exactly the same time as this episode of Membrane. Over on Insane in the Fembrane, we have Tracy Cashy, wonderful Tracy Cashy. She's our guest this week. I met Tracy Cashy at a gig just before lockdown when we were all allowed out. She was doing a spot before me, and I met her and I was immediately struck by her energy. She's such a positive, incredible woman. And then I got talking to her, I don't know how else to say this. Her story is incredible. A few years ago, she was diagnosed with terminal cancer, and when I found that out after meeting her, and I'm like, I was so struck by her positivity, and I just thought, I have to talk to this woman. I want to find out how you stay so positive in the face of something so tragic. I got her on, and here's a little clip just for you to have a taste.
To protect the innocent, there's a lot they don't tell you about life in general and cancer treatment.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Otherwise we'd all be clutching our crystals and thinking positively, rather than actually having any treatment.
Is it still ongoing?
Oh, blimey. It's ongoing and it's marching into Poland, also known as my liver.
I'll
kill the cancer in the end, you know, when I die. We'll both die, but it will be a very pyrrhic victory.
So, search Insane in the Fembrane. That episode is out right now. It's available on all your podcast platforms, so seek it out. It is a really good listen. So, back to Insane in the Membrane with this week's guest, Dr. Shaham Das. He's a criminal psychiatrist, and he got in touch and said he wanted to come on and have a chat. And I don't know anything about criminal psychiatry, so I'm like, okay. So I had a look at his stuff. Producer Paul was sending me some links, and we had a look, and I was like, oh, I have to talk to this guy. Because, yes, he's a criminal psychiatrist. He's a doctor, but he doesn't talk like that. He's not all starched collars and stiff upper lip. He's just an everyday guy. And we talk about that towards the end of the episode. He's just a normal guy, and I found that him really easy to talk to, and I wanted to talk to him for hours. So, do you know what? Why I don't even know why I'm doing this. Why don't we just listen to the episode? So, coming up, Dr. Shaham Das.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Thank you for coming on. I apologize. I'm a bit all over the place, to be honest. I've had to get a day job as well as my comedy and podcasting because the live stuff has all fallen away. So I'm working in a t-shirt printing shop. Okay. So I'm a bit all over the place at the minute. I do apologise.
How are you finding that?
Do you know what? I really like it. They're really good lads. It's SOS Clothing for the people that are listening. Do go online and check out their wares. And it's they're really good lads. So it's actually nice to. I'm literally just printing t-shirts and bagging them up. And it's actually it's nice to be busy. You know.
Because
I found, you know, because of the lockdown and things like that, I found, you know, you get. When you're left too long with your own thoughts, you can go down some really weird paths. Do you know what I find?
It's funny you say that, because I remember when lockdown started, I had all these things that I thought I was going to get around to do, from like reading books to tidying out my garage to all these papers that I should know about psychiatry that I haven't read for years. Yeah. And I thought, now I've got all this time, I'm going to do it. And actually, it wasn't like that at all. I just found out that I was really sort of grumpy and bored and miserable. And I actually need to keep busy to keep sane. I can't not do anything.
Yeah. I'm exactly the same. I didn't realise, because I was always getting ready for the next gig. So I didn't feel bad about sort of not doing much during the day, because all my stuff happens at night. So I was always preparing for the next thing and thinking about comedy and then doing the podcast. So I always had something. And then within 20 minutes, it had all been taken away when everything got locked down. And suddenly you're just, I was strangely zen at the beginning. And like you, I was kind of like, I've got plenty of books to read. I've got this and that. But your brain just sort of stopped. And I was just like, I just don't have the energy to do any of it. I think it was the not knowing what the future was to hold for us all. I think that kind of put a block on me.
Also, I think I'd fooled myself into thinking that I didn't do those things because I didn't have enough time. Whereas actually, I never wanted to do them. And I just pretended that I didn't have enough time.
You're so right. You can't. I almost got like a dopamine hit from telling myself I was just too busy to read that particular book or download that particular thing or whatever. And yeah, like you're right. It was just like I just didn't want to. Man, but you're a criminal psychiatrist. Is that right? Amongst many other things.
So forensic psychiatrist. So I assess and rehabilitate people who have got serious mental illnesses, who have either on trial during the court process or afterwards when they come into a psychiatric hospital. Yeah.
Like, because I was watching a video of you on your podcast, and you were saying about it's otherwise known as criminally insane. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's probably the tabloids would say,
call it.
Yeah.
Or the movies kind of call it that, don't they? To make it sound
exactly.
I don't know. Yeah, make it sound exotic.
I wouldn't be allowed to use that terminology.
No, you'd get. Sounds very cartoony, doesn't it? It's very
mentally disordered offenders is what the official term is within the professional.
And it's people that see. Would these people be criminals anyway? Like, do you know what I mean? Because I know, I know people that they do. I've known people in the past that have been up to no good, but they're not. Yeah. They don't. It's not a mental illness. It's just they're just a bit dodgy. But could you explain what it is?
Sure. Happy to. So it's basically it's a big range of people. So on one extreme end, I occasionally, not that often, but I occasionally see people who. Absolutely not career criminals, have no kind of criminal history. So we get sent with their case papers, we get their police computer national record report so we can see their previous offences. Occasionally we get people who have never committed a crime, never stepped a foot out of line. Then they become completely psychotic, usually because they've got a family history of schizophrenia, for example, and they do something horrific. So I've seen a case that immediately springs to mind is that I once assessed this 18-year-old schoolgirl who became psychotic and killed her niece when she was completely delusional, had no idea what she was doing. Obviously, that's a really tragic case. And my kind of role is to decide whether she can have like a defence of not guilty by reason of insanity and whether she should go to prison or hospital. So obviously, in a case like this, she should go to hospital. So that's kind of one extreme. The other extreme is you get people who are habitual criminals who have, like, for example, antisocial personality disorder. Don't know if you've heard of that, but it's like a it's like a flaw in your personality where you're constantly arguing with people, you're kind of aggressive, hostile, you don't care about right and wrong, you're very manipulative, and these people are natural criminals. And the vast majority of them don't need our services, but occasionally they get severe depression or psychosis. So they're people who probably would have offended anyway, to answer your original question.
Okay.
But during the period of time that they're unwell, we have to get them better.
See, there's so many layers to all of this. I had a conversation with somebody yesterday. We were talking about the subconscious. And you're like the decisions are being made that you don't even realize are being made, like in your own subconscious, which is, I find fantastic. You know, I find, this is why I wanted to talk to you, because I don't know anything about this, but I want to know, and that's why when you I was like, yes, let's have a chat. So I don't know anything, and I want to know more. You know, so just give us what you got. What got you into this? How did you start?
So I wish I had like a really inspirational tale of how I wanted to be a psychiatrist since I was a kid, but actually I got into psychiatry in a very kind of disorganized, slightly random, sloppy manner. So I went to medical school, so you have to be a doctor first,
as people do.
I had nothing better to do at the time. And so psychiatrists are all doctors first, and then you specialize in psychiatry as your specialism, as opposed to being a GP or as opposed to being a surgeon. Psychologists, and people get us mixed up all the time, only study psychology, and they only sort of work with talking therapy. So I went to medical school, and I had no idea what I wanted to do. I had no plan. It was just all one big sort of party blur for me for 5 years. And then at the end of it, I just suddenly realized that this is actually really serious. And I need to pick a career path.
Yeah, do something.
And I just remember that when I was a medical student, the psychiatrists that I work with were just cool people. They were really friendly, really welcoming. They didn't treat me like shit like a lot of surgeons did. And so I just did it for that reason, really, for the wrong reasons. But then once I got into it, I just kind of realized that I had an affinity to talk with mentally unwell people, whether they were really depressed and, you know, on suicide watch, or whether they were floridly psychotic. I just was able to do that. I was able to make them feel comfortable and chat to them. So that's kind of how I got into psychiatry. And then within psychiatry, there's all these little subspecialties. So there's, for example, drug and alcohol psychiatry, old age, child and adolescent, and forensics is one of them. And actually, I knew very little about it when I first started psychiatry, because it's kind of a slightly dark, closed world. So, for example, forensic psychiatric units are behind several locked doors, and you have to have your like thumbprints scanned into it. You can't just walk onto a forensic psychiatric ward. And I just fell in love with it immediately. I think I'm just kind of interested in criminology. You know, in my spare time, I listen to true crime podcasts. So I just like the sort of the fascinating story that all my patients have.
There is something about it. Thinking of what makes a person do certain things, you know, I find that fascinating. I think we all do. There's a lot of podcasts about serial killers and things like that, and because people are fascinated with it, you know.
They are, especially on Netflix. It's like every week or two there seems to be a new series or documentary about serial killers.
I know, there's so much of it. You get to a point, you kind of forget about the other side of it, where like people have lost loved ones to these people. Yet we're all sort of fascinated with the people with the perpetrators, you know, and you kind of start to separate it from it. You know, it's a horrendous thing, but because you've seen so much of it, you kind of start to separate it from, well, you don't think about what they've actually done, really. It kind of loses that that sort of sense of, like I say, people have lost loved ones. And yeah. I can't imagine what it must be like for the people that see these things that have actually lost loved ones to serial killers and or family members or whatever. And it must be horrendous for them.
Absolutely. I think the other thing that people don't really necessarily acknowledge or don't want to acknowledge is that most of the time the perpetrators who commit these horrific kind of offences are or were victims themselves. So with the exception of people who've become completely psychotic out of the blue and there was no background, which does happen, but it's rare, most of the patients that I see, almost all of them have some kind of horrific background. So whether it's domestic abuse, just no parental guidance since they were kids, to poverty, to drug use, almost none of them almost none of them have a normal sort of well-structured life. It comes from somewhere.
And some people, it's funny, isn't it? Because it all comes down to the individual, doesn't it? That in their makeup, that because some people, let's say take two people, they've both had horrendous things happen to them at a very young age, but not everybody goes off to become, they don't always go off and re-offend or offend themselves or become criminals and things like that. So it's fascinating, isn't it, that because I know people that have had horrendous things happen to them as kids, but they're now they don't let it define who they are, and they kind of own it. They go, yeah, that happened to me, that was a thing, but I've dealt with that now, and now I've got this life and this is what I want to do. It's a funny thing, isn't it, that you must have looked into this yourself, you know.
So the people that I see generally have all of those things you're talking about, but a mental illness on top. So they've already got these really harsh backgrounds, and they're already kind of embroiled in the criminal underworld. And then on top of that, they start hearing voices, or they start getting these paranoid delusions. So I think that's for the patients that I see, that's probably the biggest factor, is active sort of symptoms of mental illness as well as their backgrounds.
And you say it's sort of some of it's hereditary.
Yeah, absolutely. So most of the mental illnesses, or the key ones, the psychotic ones, so schizophrenia, bipolar, most of them run in families. But it's a very kind of complex mix of genes. So just because your parents or another first degree relative has it doesn't mean you will get it. It just means that you're kind of predisposed to it. Mm. And then there are certain triggers. So drug use is a big trigger. Just trauma is another massive trigger. So you're already predisposed to it, and then two or three key things happen, and then it just flips you into like these periods of hearing voices or having delusions or being manic.
I've said this before to someone, we're having a conversation, and you see people that are like walking along the street and they're arguing with themselves, and or they're arguing with someone they can obviously see. And it's always fascinating me, it's like, how comes this, you don't seem to imagine like good friends or someone that's nice. It always seems to be aggressive and do you know what I mean? And it fascinates me that it's not someone that goes, do you want to go around the shops? Should we go and have a wander around the park? And he's like, yeah, let's go and do that. It's always like, yeah, kill your neighbour. Which I find, is that because we're sort of, because human beings kind of err on the side of negativity in order to, that's our kind of survival mechanism? Or
There are one or two cases that I remember in my career where I've met people with a chronic psychosis like schizophrenia who actually connect with their voices and find them comforting.
Oh, right.
It's rare. It's in a small minority, but the vast majority do have, they have hostile voices that are telling them to harm themselves or to harm other people. And I think that is because their sort of natural psyche is quite negative and hostile. And I think, again, that's connected to the upbringing they've had. So they directly hear the voice of their abusive father or stepfather, or they kind of transfer it onto like an imaginary being of the voice they hear. But I'll tell you something interesting. So I was in New York last year on a family holiday last April, and I could not believe the number of people who were just walking around who were clearly psychotic, talking to themselves.
Really?
It was like literally every street corner had one. Yeah. I mean, you get a few of them in London. If you walk through central London, you might see maybe one or two on your average day. Yeah. But in New York, they were everywhere. Have you been to New York?
I have. It was quite full on. I've been a couple of times, and you don't really see, now and again you'll see somebody out of a city and they're wandering around sort of talking to somebody. but it seems to be more prevalent in cities. Do you think that's because of the pressure of a city?
Yeah.
Because I know cities tend to be unforgiving, don't they? You kind of, they don't care whether you can keep up with it or not. It's like, you're in the city, this is how we do it, you know, and you either keep up or you fuck off, you know, and it, do you know what I mean? That's what it seems to be. Anyway. That's how it feels like when I'm there.
I think you're right. I think that, I can't quote you any studies off the top of my head, but I'm sure I've read studies about how the incidence of mental illness is higher in cities. And I think it's because you generally get sort of poverty, immigration and deprivation within cities more than you would do in like your home counties. And also, I think a big factor is the lack of psychiatric services. So if you look at like a place in London, so to give you a solid example, in the forensic psychiatric units where I send some people from court, in London, there's always a humongous waiting list. So you're always waiting weeks, if not months, to get somebody in who's clearly psychotic, sometimes in the community, sometimes they're in prison, only because there's just so many people and so few beds. Whereas out in the sticks, out in the country, it's the opposite. They're looking for patients to fill the beds because they, you know, they've got these resources and need to fill them.
Yeah. It's funny, isn't it? Because I think everybody, there's still that old-fashioned view of go to the city, there'll be opportunities there. Do you know what I mean? And 9 times out of 10, there's too many of you and there's no opportunities. You should come out a little bit. But can you tell if someone's putting it on or not? Like if they're pretending that there's something wrong and they've just done a horrible thing and they're just trying to get away with it.
Yeah.
Do they have a tell? Can you sort of tell?
They do have a tell. So the biggest giveaway is not actually when you see that person, when you see them in person face to face. The biggest giveaway is getting their history. So when I see a defendant for the first time, the first thing I do is I try and get all of their background medical notes. If they've got psychiatric notes, if they've got general practice notes, then I get hold of them. And it's not impossible, but it is really suspicious if somebody's not got a history of mental illness or of being psychotic or unwell. And then suddenly, conveniently, when they've committed a crime, they're saying that they're unwell. It's not impossible, but it's really unlikely because psychosis and other mental illnesses, they're chronic. They don't just suddenly appear out of the blue. They can, but it's very rare, very small portion of cases. That's the first thing that raises my suspicion. You know, you're saying that you've been hearing voices for 3 years, but you've not once spoken to your GP about it. So that's the first thing. Then the second thing would be to look at the evidence in the case papers. So we are almost always sent witness statements. So that will be, say for example, somebody stabbed a neighbour, for example. That's a relatively common presentation. So I get the witness statements for all the neighbours, including the victim. And again, I'm looking for signs that somebody has been off or paranoid or shutting themselves in or muttering to themselves or saying bizarre things for the weeks and months that have led up to the offence. And then you look at the actual evidence of what happened on the day. So witness statements to the event and then when the police arrested the person. So occasionally I get cases where the police has arrested the perpetrator and they're, you know, walking around half naked, muttering to themselves. They're not making any sense. They're really agitated. All of this suggests that actually, fair enough, they are mentally ill. So the past history is the biggest kind of giveaway. And then when you actually see them face to face, to answer your question, I think you can tell. And you can tell because of this, because people who are truly psychotic don't want to or have an agenda to convince you that they're psychotic. Right. So if you're actually hearing voices and you're actually paranoid and I'm this doctor that comes in a nice suit and you've never met me before, you're not going to open up and just tell me all the things that you're feeling suspicious or paranoid about.
No.
You're going to be the opposite of that. You're going to be sort of closed down. You're going to be reserved. You're not going to be making eye contact. You might be sort of looking around a bit shiftily. Whereas the people who are trying to convince me that they're mentally unwell and need to go to hospital are the opposite of that. So within seconds, they're like, oh, doctor, I can hear these voices. Did you hear that? You know, why is that person looking through the room? And it's actually very obvious, very obvious. And also you develop a bullshit radar.
I was going to say, you've been doing it long enough that you can go, come on, for fuck's sake. Who are you? Really? Is that the best you can do? Come on.
I mean, you've got kids, right?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
And you must have developed a bullshit radar for them, right? You must be able to tell when they're telling the truth.
Yeah, absolutely. I tell you what, though, I've developed my own bullshit radar because I used to be full of it. I remember years ago, I was a bit. I've said this many times on here. I, I, I'd kind of ricocheted through life and getting into trouble in relationships and things like that. And I wasn't being truthful to anybody, to anyone around me, to myself. There's just this idiot that was bumbling around. And then I went and had counselling and I sorted myself out. And now I am the king of honesty. I get such a rush from being honest and people telling me that I'm trustworthy and loyal and all these sorts of things. I love it. So, but now because I hear, I know when someone's telling me lies because I've told the lies.
If you don't mind me asking, if it's not too personal, yes. What was that about then? What was your previous? I'm psychoanalyzing you now. I should be charging you.
I don't really know. The counsellor that I had, he said, I was addicted to the rush at the beginning of a relationship.
Yeah.
So I'd meet someone, I'd go, oh, this is amazing, and they were always the one, and I'd fling myself into that relationship, and then I wasn't honest enough later on to go, oh, actually, I'm not feeling this now.
Yeah.
And I'd meet somebody else, but then I hadn't told the other person. And then I'd end up in this, I'd have like a couple of people at the same time and I was lying to everybody because I didn't know, I wasn't honest enough to say, look, I can't do this anymore. I've met this person.
Yeah.
And it was just, I kept doing it. And in the end, I just had enough. I'm like, why am I doing this? I'm not, I knew deep down I was a better person than that.
Yeah.
I knew I was a decent man. And so having counseling helped me to find that decent person.
And do you think that would have come out anyway out of maturity and with age, or do you think you needed the counselling to really bring that out?
I think it would have done eventually, but I needed help with it then because it was so destructive. And I always felt I wasn't good enough for people as well. There was that. I had insecurities and I just thought, you know, why would anyone love this? And it was a whole mess. And then drinking too much and drugs and things like that, and just out and out carnage.
Yeah.
That I did need someone to kind of take me to one side and go, right, sit down, let's listen, let's have a chat. But it, like, it's, but yeah, as I've become older as well, you kind of realize a few things as well. So yeah, I become, when you're mature, you do realize a few things.
But good on you for actually going for the counseling, right? Because
yeah,
I'm sure there's a lot of people that have had the similar kind of emotions and thoughts and issues that you've had, but the vast majority wouldn't actually take that step.
No.
Because that's admitting that something's wrong in the first place, right?
It's, yeah, you kind of feel that you're not masculine enough, you know, because you should be a man about these things, and you push that shit down and you don't get, you're a strong man, you don't need to, there's nothing wrong with you, you just pull your socks up. And that's that sort of shit. And that's why there's so many men of, you know, now of my generation that are so emotionally stunted,
yeah,
and woefully unhappy. And I think talking about, go on.
I was just going to say, I do think it is gradually changing. It's a very small change.
But
I think. So I'm 41. I'm not young. I'm not old either. But I'm sure, like, if I remember correctly, about 20 years ago, people wouldn't have come out as easily with being honest about having mental health problems. It's not something that you would speak about openly to your work colleagues, or, you know, going to see a counsellor was very rare back then.
No, not at all.
Yeah, so it's a good thing it's changing, I think.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we've talked about this before, is that, yes, it's changing, and it is, and people are starting to open up a bit more. So we might not be the generation that actually really properly benefits from it, but the next generation will. They'll be the ones that, do you know what I mean? Because our generation, I know my dad was very, very emotionally shut down. And that caused a lot of anger and frustration. And now, I mean, he's a lot more open now because I kind of prized it out of him. You know, I tell him I love him all the time and I hug him, and even though it drives him insane. But that's, but even then, if you'd have used the words mental health 20 years ago, it would have just been assumed that you were mentally ill, rather than it being a thing of, you actually, the brain is something that you need to take care of, you know, and listen to, like, take it. That's that. Yeah. So you're absolutely right. We are making those changes, and it's happening. Yeah.
I think the other thing that's changed also is celebrities talking about their mental health.
Absolutely.
So that, if I remember correctly, when that first started happening, especially in the media, which I think again was probably around 20 years ago, I think they were kind of vilified, and you get tabloids that would have all these headlines about people taking overdoses and was it Lily Allen, just one that sticks in my head, and just the way that they were portrayed was really cruel. And I think that it's the opposite now. They're kind of applauded. And the thing is, right, I think that's a good thing. I definitely think that's a good thing. But at the same time, it also potentially marginalizes people with serious mental illnesses. So you hear the story of the celebrity who had a bit of anxiety and had a bit of depression, and they overcame it, and they went on to have a sparkling career. And that's a good story. I don't mean to denigrate that. But what about the people that I see, so people with really serious mental illnesses who spend most of their lives in hospital? You don't really get your celebrity that's got that story. So I think there's a risk that it actually marginalizes more the people with more severe mental illnesses.
No, you're absolutely right. I've had many conversations like this. It's because everybody at the moment has got a thing. Everyone's got a thing. It's like you say, there. Yes, I am. Yeah, you'd have to be an absolute psychopath to not be affected by the world, the way the world is. But there are people that have got really, really ferocious mental illnesses. But because they're so ferocious, it's very difficult to deal with. People, they just kind of get pushed to the side, don't they? It seems to be anyway. Like things that actually need to be helped. And funding for these people, like there's cuts left, right, and centre. That must be so frustrating for you when you're trying to help these people and the resources aren't there.
Absolutely. So within the world of psychiatry, over the last couple of decades, there's been a massive shrinkage of hospital inpatient beds because the government wants to treat people in the community. And I think in theory, that's a really good thing because you're giving people more freedom, more autonomy, but it doesn't really help the people who are too unwell to cope in the community. And because there's so few hospital beds now, the threshold to actually be sort of sectioned or go in under the Mental Health Act is so much higher. Even in my career, I've the kind of people that I would assess and would have admitted when I first started in psychiatry, half of them I wouldn't even be able to get into hospital now. There's just not enough spaces in the bed, so they're just struggling to cope in the community. It's really sad.
Yeah, well, it's like in the movie Joker, which I know was a movie, but there's a bit in it when like he gets his meds, he has to go and see a woman every week or whenever it was, and and he's got his diary and he's talking to her, and then one day she says, look, they've cut the funding, this isn't happening anymore, you're going to have to figure something out. And he's like, well, what about my meds and things? They're like, well, I don't really know. And yes, that was a movie, but that's actually happening in the real world, and it's horrifying.
That's it.
And what happens to these people? What do they do? They just get left.
That's a great movie, by the way. As a little side note, I actually wrote an article about psychoanalyzing the Joker and sort of doing a full psychiatric assessment on him. I'll send you a link if you're interested after this chat.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Fantastic. But it's one of my favourite movies because it was so real, and that particular bit really struck me. Because it was like, I'm like, yeah, that's actually happening. And there are actually people out there that have been, they're reliant on that, just that one meeting every couple of weeks. That's their one kind of, they're the last thread that's helping them stay attached to the world. And then it gets cut. And then what happens? They just get left. And they just get, hopefully they'll just fizzle out and die, which is just awful.
It is awful. And actually, I see these people through the criminal justice system. So 20 years ago, 30 years ago, they would have got the help when they needed it. They'd have got into hospital earlier on, they'd have been treated, and they would have at least started their journey to recovery. But what's happening now is that because there's less resources and because you have to be, the threshold for you to be admitted is so much higher, they kind of, they're just sort of pottering around in the community, and then a lot of them eventually go on to commit petty crimes, whether it's kind of lashing out due to paranoia, hearing voices, or whether it's, you know, shoplifting because they literally can't afford food. And then we see those kind of low level offenders coming in through the courts. So that's definitely changed in the last 5-10 years.
Yeah. It's that, but that's a lot of because society tells you, if you live a certain way, you're a decent citizen. You know, you've got a great credit record, which means you can borrow loads of money, and that makes you a decent citizen. And you know, but some people are just pushed to a place where they have to commit a crime in order to survive. Like you say, a very low level shoplifting, or they'll steal something because they're just so desperate. But they're just because the criminal system is the way it is. Everybody gets treated the same way. And it's like I got in trouble a few years ago. I was out with my now ex-wife, and we got into a bit of a scuffle with these fellas, and one of them called her a fat cunt. And I lost my temper. There was a lot of pressure. We were breaking up, and I lost my temper, and I punched this fella, and I got in trouble.
Yeah.
And rightly so. I shouldn't have punched him, but I lost my temper. I saw a woman, and she sort of assessed me to see if I was a danger to society and things like that. And even she, you said earlier, she checked my record, and she went, "You've never been in trouble with anything. There's nothing happened, but now this and." What is it? And I just told her the story. And she went, she goes, it all gets too much for some people, but then now they're in the system, and then it kind of rolls, doesn't it? For a lot of, I was lucky. I recognised what I'd done. I'm like, no, it was just a moment in time. I won't do that again.
So what happened in the end? Did you get charged or?
I got charged with assault, and I got done for. I got done for assault, and I did 150 hours community service. And I got a fine. Yeah. And I genuinely felt bad. I didn't. It's not. I'm not proud of it. This isn't me going, "Oh, check me out." I genuinely was. It was a moment in time that it was like, it was really rock bottom. That's when the counselling started as well. All that kind of triggered me. It was like, that was my life. That was like, come on, man. This is ridiculous now.
And how did you find the community service?
Oh, man. What an eye opener that is. Meeting other people, like young lads, young lads that are. The way they were talking was just—they're just in the system. They are criminals. That's just their way of life. They just don't. They've never had any other opportunities, so they just go, "Well, look, this is what my dad did. This is what I do, and this is just what we do." And it was a real eye opener, and it really made me recognize my privilege for sure. That I've been lucky that I've not. That's not been my experience at all, you know. So I was grateful to see it, and it made me realize a lot about my own life. But it made me realize I never want to do litter picking on the Broadwater Farm estate again.
So it's a good deterrent then.
God, not half. That'll learn you. Don't do that. But I was lucky. I had people around me that helped me and you know, brought me back out and I've done my best to be a better person, but some people just get caught in the system, don't they? And they don't see any other way, and then they just get lost, don't they? They get cut off and lost, and I don't know what the answer is. Is it more funding?
Oh, the answer is definitely more funding. I think that's the answer to most social problems. But it's also about how it's spent as well, because I'm not always convinced that the system always works in a particularly efficient way. So I'll give you an example. No. In court diversion, where I work, we pick out the defendants that need to go to hospital. And one of my biggest bugbears is that the actual process of sectioning somebody under the Mental Health Act is really slow and clunky. So if I, as the doctor that works in the court, I can give one opinion, and then they have to get out like a senior social worker from the borough who's always got a backlog of cases, and a second independent doctor. And to do all of that together in one day and do the assessment is almost impossible. And then if you don't manage to do it before the court shuts, which is about 4 or 5, then they get remanded in prison overnight. And loads of funding was kind of put into this system, but I think it was put into the wrong places. So there was just too many managers that were thrown in, and too many sort of voices, and nothing that actually sorted out the protocols. So I guess the point I'm trying to make is that it's not just money, it's also like using it in an effective way.
Where it goes.
Yeah.
It just feels like the whole system needs to be rejigged, re-evaluated. But I don't know, but it's so... Yeah, like you say, there's so many different parts, aren't there? There's, you know, it's... I don't know. I'm just talking from an outsider's point of view. I'm not in. My dad works for Citizens Advice Bureau, and on that level, he just finds it so frustrating that you know, he gets people coming to him with, they're just desperate, and he can only do so much because there's so much bureaucracy in front of him. Yeah. You know, there's so much bullshit, and you've got to talk to more than one person, and you've got to wait for letters to come back and forth, and it just seems to be. There must be a better way to do it.
Yeah.
You know?
That's what you're talking about sounds really familiar within the mental health system as well. It's all very kind of fractured and disjointed. So there's like a team like that I work in the courts, and then there's another psychiatric team in the prisons, and then there's like the probation service who also make decisions on whether people are safe enough to be on bail or not, and then you've got a community team who also has responsibility for the patient. But then if they've committed their offence in a different borough, then that community team no longer gets involved, so another community team gets involved. And it just feels like too many cooks, really. There's just, like you say, there's too many people involved. And the answer isn't throwing more money and getting more people in. The answer is just to simplify
the system
and make it run smooth.
Yeah. I think that's what it... But it's... Yeah, it just needs just completely taken apart and just... Yeah, just... We need to be given a shit about actual people. They just become figures, numbers on a screen, don't they?
Yeah.
You know, and it's... And then when you see... When you see they give the figures out and they go, oh, crime's up in this area or it's down in that area, and you're not really dealing with anything. I don't know. I see. When that's what I did see in Tottenham was on that estate. You just saw people with nothing. That estate in particular, these people just had nothing. And they were like, well, why should I give a shit about these? No one gives a fuck about me.
Yeah.
So why should I give a fuck? And these people are just with nothing. So they get into drugs or they do whatever. And it was really interesting to see. But again, I don't know what the answer is with that. What do you do? Do you inject money into the community? Because I don't know how many of those kids are going to want a table tennis table. I don't think that really works, is it, anymore? Youth club.
Yeah, I don't think. I suppose when you're looking at the harsher boroughs and the kind of slightly ghettoised boroughs in London, then it is really hard to come up with a solution. But then I think there are some sort of areas that work well. Like you have these youth football teams.
Okay.
That tend to flourish. You get sort of like, you know, these little DJ sets and people that can make like underground music. They tend to keep a few kids off the street. I think it's just tailoring it to what the kids want to do rather than what the councillors think the kids want to do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, ping pong is not the answer. Yeah, you're right, man. That is it. Because these kids, they do want to be DJs and they want to be more creative. I found that a lot. People, they do want to get into music. And my eldest son is a dancer.
Yeah.
And he does choreography and he gets a lot of, you know, people in... Yeah, that's what they want to do. They want to be creatives. And I think, yeah, like that's where you're, do you know what? You're right. That's where we should be focusing. I think, you know, like you say, do what the kids want to do rather than what some pompous old twat in his 60s thinks is the right thing for the youth.
You know what, Rich? I think we sorted out.
Let's form a, we'd be like the Batman and Robin of, yeah, you could be Batman and I'll be your sidekick. I think that's the way forward. But it must be, you must enjoy what you do, like figuring people out. I know I enjoy it. I love working people out. I love, people tell you more about themselves than just speaking, don't they? And I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love body language. I watch videos about body language all the time. I love that. You must love that.
I do. So for the average assessment that I do, I probably spend about an hour with the actual client, whether that's a defendant in like prison or in hospital. And I spend probably about 10 or 11 hours actually writing up the report. So it is interesting. I do enjoy it, but it's less glamorous than you think it is, because the actual bit where you figure the person out, which is, I agree with you, the most interesting bit, is the conclusion. It's almost like you have to show your work. So when I write a court report for a judge, I have to come up with a conclusion, like they have this mental illness and this is the evidence of these symptoms and this is what his mental state was like at the time. But it has to be absolutely watertight. And the reason for that is because if I do a report for the defence, then the Crown Prosecution Service, if they don't like what I've written, then they can call their own psychiatrist and then we sort of battle out in court. Or vice versa, sometimes any cases for the Crown Prosecution Service as well. To preempt their strikes, you have to go through all of the notes and pick out every single piece of information in detail and cluster them together into symptoms and diagnoses. So I guess what I'm trying to say is it is fun. The final bit, the conclusion is fun, but the actual going through the pages of evidence can be a little bit dull at times.
Oh, God. Oh, yeah, I can imagine. And like you say, it's got to be so meticulous and watertight. I mean, how is your own mental health with this? Do you have things that you do to protect yourself? Because sometimes it must. Do you find it easy to kind of put it to one side and go off and do things like relax and have some kind of social life?
Yeah, I do, and I don't really know why. I don't think it's something that I learnt. I think I've just always managed to disconnect. So some of the perpetrators have done horrible things, from like, you know, sexual crimes to paedophilia. But as I said earlier on, they're also, a lot of them are also victims themselves. And it's not that it doesn't bother me. It's not like I don't care. I do. But I'm also just very able to compartmentalize what is work and not take it home. So occasionally I'll tell my wife about cases that I've seen, and she's like horrified about what's actually happened and what the person's done. And I am much more interested in the psychiatric defense than I am about the kind of morality of what they did. And I honestly don't know why. I'm just possibly borderline psychopath. I just can, it doesn't bother me. It doesn't affect, you know, my life. And I think another thing is that I always keep really busy. I've got so many other things in my life. Yeah. I've got my wife and kids. I've just started a new podcast recently.
That's right.
Dabbled
in
stand-up, as you know.
I do.
And I think because I've got so many other things, I'm too busy to get kind of bogged down by seeing people that have done horrific things. I don't really have time to kind of concentrate on the fact that somebody, you know, severely beat up their spouse, because by the time I think about it, another case has come along, and then another podcast episode comes along.
Yeah, just keep it busy. Yeah. Well, I mean, that, you know what, that's, you're so right. Like I said at the beginning, it's when the lockdown happened and I was left alone with my own thoughts, that's when it started to get weird. And I saw that as well. People kept putting on Twitter and things like that, talking about how vivid and mad their dreams were. And I read a thing in National Geographic, and it said, because you've had all the distractions of everyday life have been taken away from you, your brain is now it's just sort of left to its own device, and it's processing everything. So it was just chucking out all these mad stories in your head. In dreams were incredible. They were nuts. And you're right. You keep busy, but I suppose that's what makes you good at what you do. It's not because you don't. You're not a psychopath. You're just able to go, well, that it's just, I can't, it doesn't affect me, because it just doesn't, you know, and that's good. Yeah. Cause I know, you know, I used to work in an old people's home, and I used to take that home with me. I think more of like that's probably where we'll all end up. And it made me a bit morbid, to be honest.
So you used to think about it outside of work.
Yeah. I'd be like, oh God, these poor people in these homes. And it used to, I mean, but like you say, after a while you get busy and you don't have time to think about it. But I think that's the key, isn't it? Keep busy and don't let it in. Don't let this shit in.
I think it's the key for some people. I think people are just wired differently. So some people like doing nothing and relaxing. I've just never understood that. I'm the kind of person that would go down to the beach with my family and just get bored within the first 10 minutes. Like, what's the point of this? Like, why would I want to lie down and look at some sand in the sea? I want to do something. I want to be stimulated. But, you know, other people don't share that kind of viewpoint. So, yeah, I think we're all different.
Yeah. This is it. I mean, I don't mind doing that for a day. 2 days at a push on a holiday. And then I'm like, right, okay, we've done this now. Let's go and do something. Yeah, I'm the same. I can't. Well, my dad always says, I'll come into the room, but I won't sit down. I'll be stood by the door, but watching the television. And he's like, just sit down. What are you doing? I'm like, I'm always ready to go. And I don't know what that is. It's just, I always need to be doing something. But have you had anything with the lockdown? Have you had to deal with anybody that's been severely affected by it?
So yes, kind of. So I for the first couple of months when the restrictions first started, I had a massive decrease in my caseload, and it kind of picked up, I think, because it took a while for the courts to get used to and the prisons to get used to video conferencing and stuff. But for a couple of months, I joined this voluntary organisation called Frontline 19. And it was like, it was run by psychologists. I'm a psychiatrist, but it was run by them, and they were giving like therapy to people who were frontline NHS workers who were really struggling. But for people who went beyond that and who were like suicidal or semi-suicidal, they would escalate the cases to me, and I would like assess that person remotely. And it was kind of a weird thing because I wanted to help, obviously, that's why I signed up. But I felt quite sort of flaccid because I had no jurisdiction over the patients. I wasn't officially their psychiatrist. I didn't work for their community mental health team. And the mental health services are very territorial in this country. It's very weird. Like if somebody's in your borough, in your area, you own them and everybody else can has to kind of mind their own business. So what I was doing was sort of writing up these assessments in detail and sending out these reports to other psychiatrists, kind of politely saying, look, I don't want to step on your toes, but I think this person is, you know, at quite high risk, and these are the reasons, these are the factors, this is what's changed in his life, this is what his mental state is like. And I have to say the response wasn't great. I think most of my peers were politely kind of, mind your own business, this is our patient, not yours. And I don't know, I've got mixed feelings about that because obviously I'm trying to help, I've got no agenda, I'm not getting paid for anything, but at the same time I could probably understand that if I had a caseload and some guy that I'd never heard of sent me a letter saying, you know, you're not doing your job properly, basically, can you
do
it a bit better?
Oh, yeah, when you put it like that.
it was a weird one, so it was strange.
Yeah, it must have been... I don't know anybody that was a frontline worker, not really. It must have been so intense for a lot of them. And it was the... And again, it was the... It comes down to the lack of funding and not having the right. They didn't have enough PPE, you know. Yeah, it was. I don't know how these people got through it. It was, you know, it was incredible, wasn't it? That.
Yeah.
Because nobody knew what they were doing. It kind of came out of nowhere, didn't it? And so to suddenly be thrust into this, right? You've got to deal with this, which could potentially kill you. Of course you'd be on edge.
Yeah, this is sort of a random side story, but I remember, do you remember the clapping thing every Thursday?
Yeah.
We had to go outside and clap. I fucking hated that. I was the only person, I'm the only person on my road that works for the NHS, and I fully admit I'm not frontline. I work in courts assessing defendants. I'm not out there saving lives during COVID. I wasn't. But I still felt like it was just really patronising. I just felt like I had to be seen to go outside and clap, even though I couldn't give a shit about people clapping for me. Because what is that? Do you know, what is clapping? How does that change anything or help?
Doesn't
anything?
Do anything. I know. It doesn't change anything. And there might have been people that have been working nights, NHS workers, and you're outside banging pots while they're trying to get some kip. You know, I'm like, is that the best we can do? And everybody was like, yeah, we've done our bit now. We've clapped. You know, like, well... What the fuck are we doing? This is ridiculous. We should all be actually getting together and go, right, what actually can we do? Is there a way we can do something that's actually going to make a difference? Clapping on your balcony with a couple of pots in your hand.
And I didn't want to, but I kind of felt like I had to because I didn't want to be like...
You had to.
The only antisocial person in the family.
You'd get... Oh, number six aren't coming out. Right, what's wrong with them then? You know,
They better be dead. They better have COVID.
It was the only way you could get out of it is if you'd suffered with it. Yes. I don't know, man. I don't know. I do worry that the government aren't, not with COVID, but with actually taking care of people that desperately need help. They're not focusing on it, are they? I don't know, man. It worries me, you know?
Yeah,
and it, you know, and suicide, you know, the numbers for suicide are ridiculous, and you know, and I think we need to start talking about that a bit more. The fact that, because straight away they go, "Oh, are you having suicidal thoughts?" Oh, then you know, I don't know many people that haven't had suicidal thoughts. they haven't done it, but they've gone, "Oh, fuck this, I'm just going to go." I don't know many people that haven't had that. You know, I don't know if it's different for you, but I know I went through it. I'm like, and. Have you experienced that yourself or?
No, I've never had suicidal thoughts. I've definitely had times where I felt low. I think that but towards the beginning of the COVID restrictions, I when I wasn't busy, I just felt really uncomfortable. I surprised myself at how sort of moody I'd become with just not being kept busy. But no, I've not had suicidal thoughts. I deal with patients with that kind of thing all the time. And I think the thing is that when people talk about it, they say you should get help, which absolutely you should. But also getting help isn't the end of the problem. So it's not like somebody hides suicidal thoughts, then one day has the bravery to accept them, then goes and sees a doctor and that's it. They get cured and they go away. That's not how it works at all. No. You might get treatment and you might, for example, take antidepressants. You might start, you might have therapy and all those things can help, but they're all very, very gradual, kind of slow burning kinds of treatment. Or if you're extremely suicidal, you might go to an inpatient hospital, you might be observed, but that's not actually really changing your life. That's just keeping you safe in the short term. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that people shouldn't do those things. They absolutely should do those things. But I just think that our narrative of suicide is a bit simplistic.
Yes.
I think that when somebody's got really deep-rooted problems, then it's not something that's going to be fixed within a couple of weeks or months. It's just it's a lot deeper than that, I think.
Well, like you said, I said, you know, I've had suicidal thoughts, I've spoken to somebody else about this, and they were saying to me that it's not... You don't really want, a lot of people don't really want to kill themselves. They just want the hurt to stop. They want that. They want that. They want they want the frustration to go. And so you get that, you get confused. You're like, you don't really understand the magnitude of suicide. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. You kind of like, I just want to, I'm just going to go. But you don't really want to, you just want that shit to stop.
And having the thought is a big difference from actually going through with it. I mean, actually doing something about it's a huge, huge step. So do you mind telling me a bit about what was going on with the suicidal thoughts? What was your kind of situation at the time?
I think it was just in, like, my partner and I now, we were just at each other the whole time. It was just before, lockdown. And we just kept fighting, but really epic fights. And And I just walked out and I'm like, because I thought this was the one. I thought this was going to be the relationship that I'd been chasing all this time. And then this was going to down the shitter. And I remember walking out up by Southend Pier and I'm just like, I'm just going to do it. Fuck it. I'm just going to do it. I've had enough. No one gives a shit. Maybe it'd be better if I just wasn't here. I just seem to be getting in everybody's way.
Yeah.
And then in the argument, I just smashed my phone. And then I just went, I better sort my phone out. And then I went and got a 3-year contract. So I'm like, well, I'm obviously not gonna do it. So
that's a protective factor then, right there, isn't it?
Yeah, like it matters if I've got a contract or not. But that was my thinking. I'm like, I better go and sort my phone out. But some people don't have that. Some people, I know of someone who actually did it. He actually did, but nobody saw it coming. Right. That's the thing, isn't it? No one sees it coming. Yeah, he did. He was a boxing. He was in the boxing world. Dean Powell. Unfortunately, he took his life a couple of years ago, and it was such a shock because no one saw it coming. Every time he was out, he was just this lovely guy. I remember sitting and talking to him about how best to look after your shoes. You know, like polish them and do this and do that. And then I remember I was on holiday and I just saw they were talking about him. I'm like, what's going on here? And then he just decided it was all too much. But nobody knew. That's the thing. Really?
Assessing suicide risk is quite a common kind of area in psychiatry, obviously. Yeah. So not so much in my criminal work, but I also do civil court cases. So I occasionally do clinical negligence cases where somebody's committed suicide and their family is trying to sue the mental health team that were looking after them, either in the community or occasionally they actually commit suicide while they're in a psychiatric hospital. I do kind of assessments on both sides for the claimant, so the family, or the defendant, which is the NHS Trust. And it is it's really variable. So like your friend Dean, there are certainly a cohort that you just absolutely don't see it coming. I mean, there's like demographic things. So if you're male, if you're middle-aged, if you're an alcoholic, if you've got a mental illness, if you've just been through a divorce, if you've got mental illness within a family, those are kind of historic factors that you can't change. But when you actually get people that present to psychiatric services, it's really confusing because you get some people, women especially, who can deliberately self-harm or take overdoses repeatedly. And they can do it for years and they, you never really know whether they intended to end their lives or not, because not every suicide attempt is an actual real attempt. Sometimes it's a call for help. And there are some factors, like, for example, did they call the ambulance themselves? Did they take all the tablets that were available? Did they take out a 3-year phone contract before they did it? It's just so complicated. And some of the cases, you just cannot predict it. And some of the cases that I've done with clinical negligence, I'm just sitting there and I read through the notes. I'm just like, how can the mental health team have not picked up on this? It was so obvious that they were just deteriorating, like their frequency of telephone calls, the frequency of crisis, the frequency of cutting themselves had clearly increased. Plus they had this conversation with their family member that you knew about, saying goodbye to their kids or something like that. And it's just, the signs are just glaringly obvious to me. And it's just, I kind of cringe when I read through this material. Obviously I know the final outcome, and yeah, some of it is indefensible.
Yeah, right. And do you think it just comes down to them being understaffed, underfunded? They've got too much going on?
I think it's two things. I think that it is that their caseloads are too high and they're overworked, especially community mental health teams. But the other thing is that it shocks me how bad some risk assessments are done. And just to be clear, I'm not talking about all members of staff by any means. I'm talking about the occasional few that come across my thresh, that come onto my desk. But they will, so their attempt at a risk assessment is, are you going to kill yourself? Do you have thoughts of suicide? Yes or no? And that's it.
Oh, wow.
And that's just bullshit. That's not an assessment. Yeah, exactly. So they've not, so say for example, somebody's had a suicide attempt a few days ago. If you're doing a proper assessment, if you want to know whether somebody's likely to kill themselves, you need to get to the root of exactly what went on. So what was happening on the day that they had their suicide attempt a week ago? What were the factors? Who do they argue with? What kind of closure did they get? Who did they speak to about what? And did they kind of indicate that they actually wanted to end their lives? What made them change their mind is a huge, huge question to ask, and it very rarely does get asked. So if there was an external factor which is now gone, then the chances are they're going to be safe. But if there's an external factor that's still very much in the background, then they're not going to be safe. So it's not that complicated to do, really. It just takes a bit of time and a bit of effort. But I see these risk assessments, and they look like somebody's just done it as an afterthought because they've run out of time, rather than an actual method to stop somebody.
Yeah. And what would you say to someone if they were thinking these things?
I would absolutely suggest that they seek help. So I think that to get help immediately, the best ports of calls are the Samaritans. I think they're really well established. They have proper trained people who can really sort of listen to your thoughts and concerns. I think that you need to accept and acknowledge that it is a long road to get better. It's not simple. Even engaging with the services might be fairly difficult. It might take weeks, but there is help out there and people do get better. Like I've seen dozens of cases of people who had very serious suicide attempts and have turned their life around. So if it can happen to somebody else, then potentially it can happen to you as well. It does happen. People's mental states do change. People do get better. Depression does go into relapse and remissions over time. So just because you're feeling one way now, that's not the be all and end all. Doesn't mean you're going to feel like this forever.
Yeah, and I think that's it. That's the key, isn't it? It's that, because when you are in the depths of despair, you just don't see that there is a way out. You just don't feel that this is how it's always going to be, and and you don't feel. And then there's that thing where you don't feel like you can reach out. You know, you think, oh, everyone's too busy. They don't want to listen to this. You know, and I say this a lot on here. Just message someone and just say, how you doing? Look, I'm feeling this way, and most people will talk to you. You know, don't ever feel that people are too busy. I think that's the key, isn't it?
And also that it's more common than you think.
It's
as you said yourself, people have suicidal thoughts. It's not that big a deal. It's not that rare, actually.
No, don't feel. Yeah, exactly. Don't feel that you're weird because you're having these thoughts. Because, like you said, loads of people have these thoughts. I really find people fascinating, and I love watching and sitting with people and just trying to work out what they are, who they are and what they're about. I find that fascinating.
Yeah. And do you think you're good at it? Can you read people?
Yes. I think I can. I like to think I can, but I'm probably, I don't know. I think I can work people out based on the other, not just what they're saying, what they're just how they are. And I get a buzz off of that. But yeah, I wouldn't say I'm not, I wouldn't, there's no way I would, you know, I'll probably get it wrong. I get it wrong a lot. But I do find it fascinating. But so you've got a podcast out that's just started, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So yeah. It's very new. I've only got 4 episodes out so far. I just think that I've got a lot of interesting cases, and I think that all the backstories of most of the patients I see are fascinating, and I think that there's a space for people to hear about that. I've looked into some other mental health podcasts and blogs, and there are quite a few around, and I've found a lot of them to be quite dry and a bit serious. So they're kind of about studies or going through diagnoses in loads of detail. So I wanted to do something that's a bit different, and I think my USP is just talking through my cases. So most of them are criminal cases about how specific symptoms have led to specific kind of offences. And some of them about the civil stuff like suicide as well.
I think that's what it needs. When I was looking at your stuff, you speak in a way, your whole demeanour and way is you're obviously a very intelligent man, but you sound like an everyday dude, like your language as well. And that, I think that's what people need. That's how you'll get to people, is by, like with this podcast, IF and Jeff, and I say all manner of stuff, but, and I'm not an expert by any way, of course, in any way, shape or form, but I just want to talk about it and have people on that I'm learning from. And then people listening will go, oh, okay, yeah, that's interesting. And that's how you help people, by just being like you. You're just you come across as an everyday kind of guy.
Thank you.
And I think that's so much better than just sitting there, you know, reading off case notes and you know, being all sort of like Radio 4. No disrespect to Radio 4, but you know, it's a bit fucking dry sometimes. You know, and that, you know, that's, you know, that's your right, you know, your way.
Thank you. That's nice of you to say. I'm a psychiatrist, but I don't think that defines who I am. I'm a man who does many things. One of those is psychiatry, whereas I think a lot of my peers, that's all they do and that's all they want to do. So, you know, in their spare time, they're kind of writing papers or doing research, which is good. I'm not dissing those guys, but it's never me. It's just one thing that I do. It's not who I am.
Yeah. You're too busy doing everything else. I was looking you up, and like, is there nothing this man doesn't do? I mean, even like, what was it, rap? You've been doing rap battles, is it?
Yeah. I did a rap battle once on a TV show against another doctor. Yeah. That was terrifying. That was so scary.
I bet it was. Did you speak to each other beforehand?
Yeah, we met. Chima was the name of the other guy. His GP. Yeah, he's a cool guy. We met each other on the day. So they, well, it was all there really early, but we weren't actually recording till the afternoon. So we just sort of hung out beforehand, practiced a little bit. So we knew each other's verses. We practiced a couple of times.
Yeah.
And then did the show, and then just went out on the piss afterwards, actually. So ended up drinking with him until like 3 or 4 in the morning. So yeah, it was all good. No, there was no bad blood there.
It's shit like that. Like, you do what you do. You're a criminal psychiatrist, but then you'll get on the lash till 4 a.m. And that's what I like about you. You're a real person, and that's fucking brilliant. And that's what's needed. That's what's needed to aid people with their mental health. Not this stiff and starchy bollocks. We need you getting on the lash till 4 a.m. and then going into the office hungover.
Just in case my bosses are listening, that was a one off. That was a one off.
I'd just like to say I said that. He didn't say that. This is just me being a comedian taking the piss. You've done comedy as well, haven't you? You've done some gigs.
Yeah, man. So I was only ever an open micer. I was never an experienced comedian by any means. But I did about 40 gigs, I think, over the space of about five months, a couple of years ago.
That's still a lot of gigs, man.
I have to say, I found my brief stint in comedy way harder than forensic psychiatry. Way harder.
Really?
I take my hats off to comedians such as yourself. Yeah, absolutely.
But you made that step. There was, you know, so many people are like, oh, I'd love to do that. But the hardest bit is making that step onto the stage. Once you overcome that,
done it. Yeah, I mean, like, I think the writing jokes and shaping jokes obviously is an art form, is a craft that needs to be done well. And having the balls to get up on stage also are huge factors. But for me, the reason that I found it so hard was just the fact that it's first of all, it's really competitive and time consuming. So I'm sure you can relate to your sort of early days when you first started. There's so many open mics.
Oh, for sure.
Especially in London. So I'd go to gigs when they were like, you know, the gigs were like 3-4 hours long. So I'd leave my house at six in the evening, come home at midnight, and I, you know, for 5 minutes stage time. And on top of that, half the time there was no audience, or there was like two people in the audience, which would just be crushing because I'd spend, you know, hours writing all these new jokes and memorizing them, and then you just get to a gig and there's nobody there. I just couldn't do it. Like,
oh man, you're doing it to the tops of other comedians' heads because they're writing their notes and there's nobody else in the room, and you just got to, if you could get past that, you'll probably be all right in the comedy world. But it's just trying to break through.
What, you mean the open mic stages, you mean?
Yeah, you've really got to want to do it. And I just was so determined to do it. I really wanted to do it, be a comedian. And that's got to be a mental illness as well, isn't it?
That's narcissistic personality disorder. Yeah.
Do you know what, though? There must be an element of that in there. I just love making people laugh. That's why I do it. I just love, I love that. I don't feel there's a separation between me and the audience. I still feel like a punter. So I don't walk on thinking I've got the higher status. I'm kind of like, let's have a laugh. Come on, all of us together. Let's do this. That's how I feel.
Yeah.
And I just love doing it. So if anyone listening, if you're thinking I'd love to give it a bash, go and give it a bash. Go and find an. I mean, you might say no, but anyone, just go and you don't just sit there thinking I'd love to. I'm a bit scared. Go and do it. You never know what'll happen, I reckon. Do you think you'll go back and do it again, or is that it?
The problem with me is I started too late. So I was about 2-3 years ago. So I was 38 when I started, and it's not the age thing. It's the fact that I had so many other commitments, like trying to do that plus my job, plus my wife and two kids, plus, you know, like I exercise every day and things like that. For the 6 hours or 5 or 6 hours that I was giving away 2 or 3 times a night, it wasn't enough for me. Just 5 minutes of stage time. And I don't know if you can relate to this, but just the non-linear kind of progress of knowing whether jokes work or not. So jokes that did work on some days wouldn't work on other days. And it really pissed me off because I was like, I thought I had this. Like, I thought this is a funny joke. Yeah. So what does that mean? Do I have to rewrite my whole thing now? And vice versa, jokes that didn't work some days, they were killing other nights. And I didn't like the lack of control. Either I write a joke and it's funny and you tell me it's funny, or it's not funny and I'll cut it out. But you're not allowed to laugh sometimes and not other times, because
because different people react differently. Like, I had a gig last night and I even said to them, I said, you're laughing at the bits where people don't normally laugh. Like, they were laughing at the setups. And then I'd drop a punchline and they were going, nah. I go, how can you not laugh at the bit you're supposed to laugh at? And it was really, I like it. I like the not knowing and the way that, what I find fascinating is when a whole group of strangers in one room can all decide as one that they don't like you. Yeah. That I find fascinating. Just that when you bomb at a gig and they just go, everybody, complete strangers, and they go, nah, not tonight. That I find fascinating.
The other thing that really hurt when I did stand up was bombing. So, like, the joy that I'd feel of a gig going well, and I had a few, like a handful of very good gigs, was nowhere near the kind of self-loathing and just frustration that I'd feel when I had a bad gig. You know, I think especially once you get over the fear and the novelty, it frustrates you if you've had a few good gigs in a row and then one goes badly.
Oh, God, yeah.
Do you still feel that now?
Yep. And it's always when I'm furthest away from home that I have a shit gig. So I've got all that time in the car coming back to assess and beat myself up and tell myself that I'm shit and I should quit and I should do this, that and the other. But I tell you, where are you based, may I ask?
North London, Enfield.
North London. Right. because we've done a few live ones of these, and we do them around about the place. How would you feel about coming back on and being a guest on a live one?
As a stand-up or as a psychiatrist?
Just as a psychiatrist, but because you've already got the stagecraft, you've already done it, so I think you'd make for a cracking live guest. I think we should do it. Yeah, would you be up for that?
Mate, I'd definitely be up for that. Yeah.
Yes.
That'd be wicked.
Right. Let's do it. Okay, we'll do that. This has been fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on. Where can we find you online?
So you can check out my new podcast. It's called A Psych for Sore Minds.
Excellent name.
Or you can hit me up on Twitter. I can't actually remember my Twitter handle. I think it's at dr for as in doctor underscore s underscore das.
Excellent. Excellent. This has been fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on. And I'll be in touch. I'm definitely going to get you on for a live one. It'll be fascinating.
Cool, man. I'm definitely up for that. Yeah. Definitely up for that.
Produced by Paul Daniels at pauldaniels.tv.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Made by darkhorsedigital.co.uk. Shooting, live streaming, and podcast production.